As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
I think Nunez probably also deserves a start. We've been talking about him as this big number nine, as if because he's quite tall, it means Liverpool should just be getting the ball wide and getting him into the box. But actually, he was really good with his runs in behind against Arsenal. I mean, he just happens to be tall. It's not like he's second coming of Niall Quinn.
And Liverpool did it so well against Manchester City in the FA Cup, of just really getting them in a bit of a chokehold, pressing them really high, which we know that the best version of Liverpool like to do. Maybe if they do play something of a front four, they can try and really go for the throat there as well.
City are so good at getting runners in behind the defence that I would worry about that. And it's not just the obvious players, it's not just Haaland. I thought Bernardo Silva against Manchester United was constantly making runs into that left-hand channel. Obviously, we know De Bruyne loves doing the same on the right.
Hello, welcome. Welcome back to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Good to have you with us again this week. I'm Ali Maxwell. Today, Liverpool, Manchester City, Liverpool versus Manchester City, and some big six striker analysis. A big episode for a big week, and I've got two big, big contributors, friends and colleagues, Michael Cox and Mark Carey with me. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good, Ali.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
We've been a bit reflective this week, haven't we? We were asked by some of our Athletic colleagues to pause for thought and reflect on almost 3 years of the Athletic Football Tactics pod, formerly known as the Zonal Marking podcast. And it was a useful experiment, wasn't it, Michael? We've done over 140 episodes. It is some back catalogue. We've come a long, long way together.
Yeah, it was good. And I think the nice thing is quite a few of the episodes are kind of timeless, and I don't mean that in an arrogant sense. I don't mean they're absolute classics, but you know, you could go back and listen to them, and then they weren't discussing the topics of the week. There's stuff on free kicks and stuff on the away goals rule and stuff on, you know, all sorts of things. So yeah, it was quite fun going through the back catalogue.
Mark, how long have you been with us now?
It must be almost coming up to a year, I suppose. And then I was on a couple of times before I was a regular. So I don't know how many episodes I must have been on in total now. Well, I'm definitely in double figures.
Should have a spreadsheet. Adam Hurry has a spreadsheet for football cliches, honestly.
Does he?
Really?
Yeah, because at the start of it, so I think it was Charlie Eccleshare was on the other day, and he said this is your 125th appearance, and he compares it to an England player with that many caps, which is obviously Peter Shilton in his case.
What other columns are on this spreadsheet? Any ideas?
I'd love to find out, but I don't know.
I guess one of the reasons I asked, Mark, I was wondering if we reckon you've had a big enough sample size yet to definitively say how you're performing.
Yeah. Well, there's no excuses now, is there? Because I do have a big enough sample size to be able to show, do I have consistency? Am I volatile in my output? Who knows? I'll let the listeners decide on that one. I can only let them decide.
Yeah, the variability of your performances is notable for its consistency, I would say. No, it's good to look back. And just a reminder to anyone listening, particularly those who may have only joined us in the last few weeks and months, as Michael said, we've got a lot in the back catalogue, and a lot of it we honestly think you'd enjoy listening to now, even if we recorded 2 years ago. So scroll down through the feed, pick your poison, really, from some of those early episodes. They were great fun to record, and we hope you'll enjoy them. And a huge thank you to anyone that's listened since the beginning, because it's been a great journey. And yeah, there's a lot of things people don't see. You know, the weekly effort of the production team, the tears, the laughs, the issues caused by faulty microphones or dodgy headphones or barking dogs or building work. I think we got a bit of that today. Anyway, let's look forward. Let's look forward a couple of days to Liverpool against Manchester City. This is at Anfield on Sunday, 4:30 p.m. Michael, we've done episodes on this fixture before. Comfortably the best two teams in English football for the last 4 years. So this has consistently been the biggest fixture in the Premier League for a period. Can we still call it that right now? A time where it feels like the two best sides in the country have moved in opposite directions over the last few months.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, it's not first versus second. I think it looks like Arsenal are going to be City's strongest challengers this year. But yeah, I would still think of it as the biggest game in English football. I think if City inflict a further defeat on Liverpool, I think that plunges them further into, I wouldn't quite say crisis, but they will be in a very difficult situation in the table. But also, I mean, even before Liverpool really started to challenge City in the league, they always seem to fare well against Guardiola City compared to some of the other top teams. So I always think of this as a game that is maybe more even than you'd expect. And let's hope so, as neutrals, because on the basis of this season so far, you'd be predicting a 3-0 City win, I guess.
Yeah, Mark, where are you at with that? Because, you know, you have both the objective analysis gene and also some emotional connection as a Liverpool fan. It always strikes me that, you know, as they say, that there always has to be one Premier League team, ideally a Big Six Premier League team, that is being seen to be in crisis. To what extent that is true or not doesn't always matter that much. When you're a fan of that club, but you're also objectively analysing performances, you know, how do you tally that? How concerned are you at the moment with Liverpool's start to the season?
Yeah, I mean, how I deal with it is probably with great difficulty to try and, yeah, compare the objective and the subjective. But I think in a lot of things, maybe it's because of my job, it's never in any team's case, it's never as bad, I think, as people might make out, and it's never as good as people might make out as well. And obviously Liverpool won 7-1 against, albeit a weak Rangers side in the Champions League this week, and you think, okay, well, maybe Liverpool are back, and it's very quick to just sort of, you know, be fed by the narrative. So I still think it'll be a really difficult game for Liverpool. I think they've, while there's confidence increased a little bit off the back of that 7-1 win, still think that City will probably have a little bit too much for them. So the short answer is I never think it's as bad or as good as maybe the narrative suggests.
Michael, does what happened in the Champions League in midweek, a City goalless draw with FC Copenhagen and a Liverpool 7-1 win at Ibrox, does that change anything here in terms of form, confidence, or in how you would have analysed or previewed this one, let's say, 2 days ago?
I don't think it changes anything in terms of City. I think for Liverpool, yeah, scoring all those goals is a big boost, particularly for individuals. I mean, Salah looked really unhappy to be coming off against Arsenal last week. So to get a hat-trick in, was it 15 minutes of coming onto the pitch? Is a big boost. More goals for Firmino, more goals for Nunes. Yeah, I think that will improve the mood at Anfield, definitely.
And was City's goalless draw in Copenhagen as simple as, this is what City are like when you take Erling Braut Haaland out of the team?
A little bit, but it was also to do with the red card. And I think it was probably also to do with the fact that they have this game at the weekend, which I think they would have been looking towards, not just in terms of fitness, but I expect in terms of tactical preparation as well. To be honest, it's basically a fine result in the context of the group. It was, I almost think they would have taken a 0-0, to be honest. So yeah, I don't think that changes too much.
Well, it's probably bad news for Liverpool as well that Haaland comes into this having had a week's rest. Let's remind ourselves about last season, where this really was undeniably the premier fixture and a hugely entertaining one as well. We had a 3-2 in the FA Cup and 2-2 all draws in the Premier League. Michael, what were the tactical storylines from those games that we might just need to look out for here?
There's so many storylines. I mean, I think that's the problem with a 3-2, a 2-2 and a 2-2, like you say. There's just so much going on and difficult really to draw complete conclusions. But to look at the Premier League games, I think the first one at Anfield was notable. The first half was dreadful. The second half was maybe the best you'll see all season. Trent Alexander-Arnold was out in that game, which, you know, is kind of relevant maybe for this weekend. But James Milner played there because I think Gomez was out as well. And he really struggled against Phil Foden, who had one of his best games of the season for Manchester City. It was also interesting that Jack Grealish started as the number 9. You very much expect that won't be happening this weekend. And another thing was that Joao Cancelo really struggled at left back against Salah, particularly in the second half. I think I'm right in saying he was a bit lucky to stay on after maybe a possible second bookable offence. And then the other game, which I think was probably the more entertaining game, certainly throughout the 90 minutes at the Etihad. City really were quite dominant in that one, I think, and created many more chances than Liverpool. And I thought the big theme from that was two high defensive lines and the fact that made it really easy for the fullbacks to overlap into dangerous positions. And actually, on quite a few occasions, actually run in behind the opposition. I remember Kyle Walker doing that a lot. Obviously, he won't be playing this weekend. Cancelo was a real attacking force in this game as well. And it was notable in that game that City were quite direct. I mean, usually this fixture has been about Liverpool being direct and City being patient on the ball. But City were actually very straightforward in the way that they passed. So, yeah, I mean, two really, really entertaining, quite memorable games. But I don't really know what the overriding theme from the games is. It was almost like they got so many talented players. They're so flexible that they can do so many different things. So, yeah, I hope we have a game as good as those two, but I'm not sure it will be necessarily similar to them.
I think as well, from a Liverpool perspective, the home game that Liverpool had last season, I think it was a couple of moments, really, wasn't it? Salah with that iconic goal that he scored, and then he set up another one for Mane. That Liverpool did have some good opportunities, but it was all about the moments that kind of was key to their attack. And I remember going back a couple of seasons ago now, and it's sort of been the case for Liverpool against Manchester City, who have dominated Liverpool in a lot of these games, that Liverpool weren't quite, I think, as attacking as they normally would be. And I get that that is to respect the quality of Manchester City. But I remember there was a moment where, I think this was the season where Liverpool were plagued by injuries, but there was a moment I remember at home where Curtis Jones went to sort of make the most of a transitional moment. And Liverpool, I think, did have the overload. And he turned back as if to think, well, it's not worth risking this attack in case I then lose it and then get counter-attacked on. And I think that Liverpool can't really second-guess themselves or be too risk-averse in these games, especially when they need the points, obviously, this weekend. So perhaps if the score's a little bit tighter, you imagine maybe Liverpool might be a little bit more cautious, which they can't necessarily afford to do. But given the quality that Manchester City have, you can see why they would obviously respect them so much.
This is one of the most interesting parts of previewing this game, I think, Michael, trying to predict how both teams will approach this, but probably Liverpool hold a little more interest. For me, last week we spoke about them starting with four attackers in the Champions League. We wondered if they might do the same in the Premier League, or if that was just because of the strength of the opposition and their idea of just blitzing Rangers like they did in the game on Wednesday night as well. They did start with four out-and-out attacking players really against Arsenal. It was a 3-2 loss. What did you make of Klopp meeting, as we discussed last week, meeting fire with petrol? How did that go? And do you think that he will approach with a similar vibe this weekend despite the injury to Luis Diaz?
Yeah, I was surprised that Klopp went with a front four attackers in that game. I think it did leave them a little bit open in midfield. I must say, I watched this game back and Liverpool were actually much better than I thought on the first watch. I think I didn't create that many chances, but they had quite a few moments where they kind of could have got in behind Arsenal's high line. A little bit like Spurs the previous weekend, actually. So I think it's quite interesting what he'll do this weekend, because obviously he's played the front four and midweek he had so many goal scorers that I think he'll slightly wonder who he can leave out this weekend. So yeah, on paper, I think the 4-3-3 would be the better approach. But I wonder, on the basis of past performances, whether we'll again see four attackers.
What do you make of this, Mark? Because we certainly do not know anywhere near as much as what's good for Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. But the four attackers, you know, that even in previewing the game, you think they might be even more open than they were in the 4-3-3. And arguably, they were even more open than they are in the 4-3-3.
Yeah, I mean, down to the very first minute against Arsenal, you could see how much they were open. I think that I listened to something interesting on the TIFO podcast, and I forget who said it now, but they sort of said about kind of the depth of the lines, where if you think of a 4-3-3, you've almost got the holding midfielder and then the number eights on a different sort of horizontal and vertical plane. So there's kind of depth in your formation. And it was almost so flat that Henderson and Thiago were sort of similarly horizontal, that there was such a clear gap in behind, especially for Odegaard to make the most of and exploit. And then you just worry that Manchester City might have a field day if that is the case again, where there's almost no central presence to kind of protect the back four. So I think to be kind of a little bit more cautious from an attacking and defensive perspective, 4-3-3 might be the way to go against Manchester City, because if they lose the midfield, then we know the quality that Manchester City possess, and Kevin De Bruyne in the half spaces, Haaland coming to the back post. We saw it in the Manchester United game for City that, yeah, you got to, I guess, think a little bit more cautiously in this game.
What are the most important tactical aspects of this one, Michael, where you think the game will be won or lost?
Liverpool's defence just looks so porous at the moment, and City are so good at getting runners in behind the defence that I would worry about that. And it's not just the obvious players, it's not just Haaland. I thought Bernardo Silva against Manchester United was constantly making runs into that left-hand channel. Obviously, we know De Bruyne loves doing the same on the right. So, that's the area I would worry about. I know there's been a lot of focus on Alexander-Arnold, but I almost think that sometimes there's too much focus on him when clearly the other defenders aren't playing particularly well. I mean, Van Dijk is not at his best. You know, the left-back situation, I don't think Tsimikas is a great player defensively. So I just think there's a lot of gaps there. And yeah, a lot of space for various City players to exploit.
And potentially, Mark, those individual defenders copping a bit of extra flack where they might point at the midfield protection. They might point at the spaces that they are having to defend because of the system that's being played and the personnel in front of them as well. You mentioned Thiago and Henderson in a midfield pivot. Brilliant players, magnificent careers, but not midfield players that you associate with eating up ground, covering spaces and just providing really solid screen in front of a back four.
Yeah, I think it's across vast sort of spaces that is the key, because Henderson plugs in the gap on that right-hand side, or had done for Trent Alexander-Arnold, but not necessarily being asked to, especially with his age now, cover as much ground. So it's more with the amount of space more so than being able to plug the gap. And Liverpool, I think, have had issues with a kind of a domino effect of mistakes being made or just being a yard off, and then the other person, the defender or midfielder, whoever it is, starting right from the attack, really, in terms of the press, then has to fill in that gap, and then they get dragged across. And you saw it for the second Arsenal goal just at the end of the first half, where Trent and Henderson both got dragged by Martinelli, and they were just trying to, it was very reactive. It didn't seem as proactive. And I think that's what Liverpool have to defend a little bit more smarter, really. And I think that maybe the whole Trent Alexander-Arnold thing, as well as just taking him out of the spotlight, but because he's injured, maybe Joe Gomez being at right back, having a bit more kind of a defensive mindset, essentially having three centre backs in your back line, might actually be a good thing against a Manchester City side who, as Michael said, do create overloads in half spaces and in specific areas to try and target. You think, well, if you've at least got a player who can play right back but is also predominantly a centre back, might actually work in Liverpool's favour.
And a beautiful rampaging run forward to set up Bobby Firmino in the Rangers game as well. So he's obviously got something of a taste for that at the moment, something to look out for. Michael, in terms of Liverpool's front line, it's an interesting question at the moment. As mentioned, Diaz, such an unfortunate injury to pick up when he really does add something pretty exciting, particularly when they've got those four attackers. I thought his dynamism was fantastic in that first half against Arsenal. What do you think Klopp will approach this game in terms of formation? Back to an extra man in midfield? And if so, who would you choose in that front line?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was unreasonable Monday or Tuesday to say that Salah could miss out after being taken off against Arsenal, and he's not playing well. I think Firmino has to play at the moment because he's playing so well. I think Nuno probably also deserves a start. I thought he played really well against Arsenal with his runs in behind. And I think that was an interesting game because, you know, we've been talking about him as this big number nine, as if because he's quite tall, it means Liverpool should just be getting the ball wide and getting him into the box. But actually, he was really good with his runs in behind against Arsenal. I mean, he just happens to be tall. It's not like he's the second coming of Niall Quinn, you know. So I don't quite know how they will play the front three. If it is to be a front three, I mean, can Firmino play from the left? Probably not. Can Nunes play from the left? Probably more likely.
That was what I was going to say as well, because he played more as a, I think it was two tens just behind a striker at Benfica. So he was able to drift towards the left quite a lot at Benfica, which he did to great effect against Liverpool in the Champions League, actually. And you think that, especially if Gomez is going to have more rampaging Trent Alexander-Arnold runs and crosses, that if Firmino is going to kind of drop off, and by all accounts Firmino has been playing a bit better on the last line when he has actually played as a number nine, which is why I think he's got so many more goals, but Nunes being a presence maybe drifting from the left to the back stick, the back post, not being occupied by, or you know, centre backs occupying him and trying to mark him, maybe kind of a deeper cross to the back post a la Haaland, might we say, that could actually be quite effective in maybe playing Nunes off the left with Firmino central because of his form, and Salah on the right in a 4-3-3.
Just can't stop thinking about Niall Quinn at the moment and wondering whether, given how well Niall Quinn worked with Kevin Phillips, you know, given how good Bobby Firmino's goal scoring form is, could we have a 4-4-2 old school style, Nunes and Firmino being Quinn and Phillips? We'd probably move Salah over to the left side, wouldn't we? So he can just cross it on his natural side, just deep crosses onto the head of the big man. Maybe get Henderson back out on that right side of midfield role that he used to play when he was younger. Again, just deep crosses, just get it in there, into the mixer. Maybe not. Michael, it's a good time to talk a little bit more about Mo Salah, I'm really interested to know what you guys can tell me about Salah right now, because I watched that game against Arsenal. I thought, personally, I thought he looked like, or looks like, a bit of a shell of the player that he was this time last year, where I'm pretty sure we had a whole discussion about the fact that because of the form of Ronaldo and Messi at that time, and Mbappe, I think, and Haaland, Salah had become, in the eyes of the majority, the best player in the world, the best player on the planet for a portion of time. He doesn't look like that at the moment. I think we always have to bring up the context of the African Cup of Nations, because it's a pretty clear drop in output, at least goal output, since then. Just 8 non-penalty Premier League goals in 23 games. He was scoring at a much higher lick then. So we're also talking the morning after he scored a hat-trick in 6 minutes and 12 seconds. So, Michael, Mo Salah, where is he at right now? What has happened?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I don't have any great theories for this. Obviously, there's been a slight change of system with more of a, as we said earlier, a proper number 9 coming in, who isn't as adept at linking players, Firmino or indeed Mane, who was playing in the centre forward role the second half of last season. So I've thought a bit of an issue is that we just haven't got him in the right positions at times. I've thought it's more been about him being peripheral and not really being involved as much as it's been his individual contributions not being quite up to scratch. But I mean, he's underperforming his XG. The stats I'm looking at should have him on about 4 goals this season, whereas he only scored 2 in the league. But yeah, the game in midweek shows that he's still capable of finishing. A couple of quite weird goals, I thought, in that game. I wasn't quite sure how he managed to squeeze them in. I'm not sure whether that was good finishing or poor goalkeeping. I suspect the latter. I suspect Edison might not concede a couple of those goals. But yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about him. I think he'll tend to come good. Whether that happens this weekend, obviously, I don't know.
I mean, yeah, I mean, if we were to look across this season and last season, I mean, it's obvious, you said it yourself, Ali, that his goal scoring has dropped off, but to look at the numbers specifically, he basically set a non-penalty goal standard of essentially 1 in 2 over the past few seasons, and that's currently closer to 1 in 4. Michael makes a good point about his kind of overall involvement. His touches are down in general, so as a consequence, his shots are down, his XG is down per 90, but not awful. He's about 0.4 XG per 90, which is similar to the likes of Raheem Sterling and Bukayo Saka in terms of the chance quality that he's getting on average, which it's more that he's just set the standard so high in previous seasons that it's not exactly like he's not ever taking a shot anymore. But I think what I wanted to do is get your thoughts on the idea that this may be a little bit by design in terms of we're seeing him take notably fewer shots, which again might be a little bit more influenced by his role wider, as you say, the formation change. But his open play chances created are massively up. So at 2.6 per 90 at the moment, small sample size, etc., the Klaxon alert, etc. But he hadn't been above 2 open play chances per 90 since he joined Liverpool. So is it that he's maybe the whole idea of him staying wider to the touchline and things like that, not getting into those half spaces, which he did really well in that cameo, you know, against Rangers and scored. But is it that he's not coming inside as much because there's other runners maybe trying to get into that space? He's thinking about Nunez when he is playing, getting into that space and not occupying, you know, overlapping and being in each other's way. Is it more that he's turning into a bit more of a feeder role in creating more chances or occupying other defenders for others to score? I don't know. I mean, when we saw him against Rangers, yeah, we saw what happens when he does come a little bit more central, but I don't know whether is it by design or just the fact that he isn't as confident, so he's maybe trying to pass and create if he isn't going to shoot and score.
Mike, have you noticed any, you know, what are the key differences in his role in the areas of the pitch that he's taking up now, the chances that he's getting or not compared to this time a year ago?
Well, I thought that he'd been staying a lot wider. I thought particularly that game they lost against Manchester United, he was almost like a proper old school winger rather than a wide goal scorer. Although I did see some touch maps on Twitter that kind of contradicted that idea. Of course, touch maps can be slightly misleading because a lot of the positional stuff is not to do with touches. And if he is constantly hanging wide rather than trying to run in behind, he might not touch the ball in either situation, but it does suggest he's offering a different threat. So yeah, I thought he's played a little bit wider. I don't know whether that links with the fullback situation, whether Alexander-Arnold has been a bit more cautious, so he's able to come inside less. But it's one of those things, I think sometimes when the whole, to me, it feels like there's just a bit of a general slump at Liverpool with, you know, almost every player underperforming. And I think sometimes it can be quite misguided to just look at individuals, whether it's Alexander-Arnold or Salah or Van Dijk, or even Nunes was getting a bit of stick for not really having the impact that some people thought. I think it's difficult really to just keep yourself completely above that kind of general malaise. So I wouldn't worry too much about Salah. I think the consistency he's shown over recent seasons suggests that he'll probably come good sometime soon.
It's interesting because, as you say, we are bringing up individuals and we're speaking, I guess, critically about their performances this season and a drop-off in them. But as you say, a lot of it is to do with the collective, is to do with the system, to do with the performances of the team. And the person in charge of the team is Jurgen Klopp. Liverpool not in great shape. Has Jurgen Klopp been taking some heat, do you think? Have there been as many questions levelled at Jurgen Klopp as there might be another manager whose team have suffered such a drop-off?
Yeah, I think so. I've seen a lot of people talking about how he's struggled in his seventh season at Mainz and at Dortmund and now at Liverpool, as if that is a...
seventh season syndrome.
Yeah, I've seen some of that. I've seen him get a little bit flustered in press conferences where I think people are asking quite pointed questions. I think that one thing to remember about Klopp and Liverpool is, and it's unquestionable that they are suffering a bit of a drop-off in performance, but I think most people would argue they've performed above their level in recent seasons, particularly when they won the title and indeed last season. They were getting 10, 15 points more than people expected. So I think we should be a little bit careful in not exaggerating the extent of their decline from the level that they probably would be expected to be at. But yeah, it's obviously not started well this season. And even in a couple of games where they have collected points, I think they've been a bit lucky. They were lucky to win against Newcastle with that last minute Carvalho goal. I thought they were quite lucky to get a point on the opening day at Fulham as well. So yeah, it's a funny one. I expect they will improve, but obviously this weekend's game feels like it comes at a little bit of a bad time for them.
Maintaining the ridiculously high standards that they themselves have set along with Manchester City over the last few years was always going to be difficult. However, it looks bad because Manchester City are maintaining those standards. Let's talk about them now, Michael. There's a sense of inevitability that Manchester City will win the title and win it quite comfortably. And Haaland obviously being the sort of the main man as part of that discussion. Is it wrong to say that the league is over? That is how it feels at the moment. I noticed that the bookies' odds currently suggesting around an 80% chance.
Yeah, I mean, that probably feels about right to me. I don't think you can say it's over when they're not top of the league to start with. But yeah, they do look very strong. I mean, there have been times in the past where we thought teams were going to run away with it and then suddenly they dropped points in a couple of games and the league title was suddenly alive. I mean, last season, at Christmas time, we thought it was all wrapped up. And then Liverpool made a storming comeback to nearly pinch the league at the end. So yeah, I certainly don't think it's over. But they do look probably a more complete team than they have been since the first two Guardiola titles, obviously because of the addition of a striker.
I mean, the only caveat that I'd say as well is that you think about momentum being so key to all league seasons. And this is just, we said it before in this podcast, this season's just such a weird one, obviously because of the World Cup. And it almost is broken down into two mini seasons. And you think, will there just be a shake-up after the World Cup where teams are starting to get momentum again, starting to get form, in some cases starting to get match fitness for players who haven't actually been playing at the World Cup, and maybe there might be some surprises thrown up there. I doubt it in terms of I think the cream will still come to the top, but there may be a little bit of a shuffle here and there, but I suppose that's why it makes it exciting.
I make it 9 of their last 11 games in all competitions that City have scored 3 goals or more. Other than Haaland getting a lot of chances, finishing them at a ridiculous rate, have there been any changes from last season in terms of their tactics, their build-up, what they're doing out of possession? I'm desperate to try and find out more about City than just Erling Haaland, basically, but if there is something to discuss.
Well, I thought the game against Manchester United was quite notable for how much the centre-backs carried the ball forward. They used Ake and Akanji at the back, which feels a little bit unusual to me. I think of Stones as usually being in there, or Laporte or Diaz, but they've got really good options. So I thought that did change the build-up. I thought the way that United wanted to press them to the side, almost cutting off a ball between the centre-backs said, well, okay, we'll just carry the ball forward and become an extra midfielder. So I thought that was interesting. I don't think there's that much different from last season in general, but I think there is more flexibility than we think sometimes. I mean, sometimes they play with two midfielders deep and one higher. Sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes it shifts within games. They do just change subtle things from game to game. And I think they've probably got as many tactical options as they ever have done, really, particularly when you consider the versatility of some of the players. And I do actually, I mean, I don't want to go down the route of kind of Guardiola overthinks things, but I do think the fact that Haaland, he's got to be in the team, unless it's a Champions League game against Copenhagen, and he's got to play in the same position. And I think that does bring some level of structure and consistency that can help City. I mean, my favourite version of the City team would be the one where Aguero played up front and had Sané and Sterling either side. And they did change things in the midfield, but I thought there was a real kind of understanding in the front three. And I wonder whether something similar is happening now, because it's not just Haaland who's playing very well. Phil Foden's having, I think so far, his best season for City. I mean, he scored a hat-trick against Manchester United. He's scored 6 goals and got 3 assists in 9 games. And he's always been a great talent, but we haven't seen him producing those kind of numbers. I mean, that's 1 goal or assist every game. And I do wonder whether he just knows his role better. He seems to have a good relationship with Haaland. So yeah, maybe the consistency of approach and attack is helping, not just in itself because Haaland's a great player, but because it doesn't change every week.
Yeah, I mean, on the Haaland thing, I think before the season started, I think there was talk of people asking, would Manchester City go a little bit more direct, a bit more transitional at times, because that was the way that you got the best out of Haaland at Dortmund. And I looked at the numbers, and if anything, the numbers show City to be even less direct this season compared to previous seasons. So they're spending longer on the ball per sequence. They're playing more passes per sequence, which might be a quirk of the early-ish season. But I would have expected them maybe to be a little bit more direct in the way that they set up. But maybe it is that, you know, if spaces don't open up against the set defences, then they're good at still being patient and working an opening until they get that high quality chance for Haaland. And as Michael said, because they are so versatile in the way that they set up, maybe it's just an amalgamate. The numbers are maybe a little bit misleading here because it's an amalgamation of all the different approaches that they may have, and it doesn't necessarily give a clear picture. So not entirely sure why that might be, but the numbers suggest they are actually less direct in their build-up from back to front.
It's an interesting question, isn't it, Michael? Because you can see why people would have thought they would go direct more often, albeit no one was expecting them to become a long ball team because of the presence of such a large striker. As Mark said, if anything, they're even more possession heavy, even less direct. I guess as Mark was talking, I thought, well, if you've got someone whose movement is that good, does the length of time you spend in possession and actually slowing it down and making defences defend for minutes at a time actually increase the chance that someone like Haaland is then eventually going to lose his man, make a good run, rather than just getting it into him? And that seems actually probably easier to defend against if you know it's going to come into him a bit quicker.
Yeah, that is a fair point. I don't think I have anything to say in response to that, but it's a fair point.
I aim for one of those every episode. I think we've gone back to back weeks where Michael's given me the old nothing else to add, Your Honour. That's what I'm going for. Mark, what do you make of it?
Sorry, I was only going to say if it's not Haaland, then as Michael said, and as you said, with opening up those spaces, making those runs, if not for him, then for opening up space for others to exploit, Bernardo Silva, Kevin De Bruyne making the run off the back of the midfield, and Phil Foden, obviously. So if not getting it into Haaland as the main man, then him opening up spaces for others with those repeated runs could be a reason why.
Michael, it will be a big old test for Joe Gomez. It's a big opportunity for Joe Gomez, but particularly with Manchester City down the left side, Cancelo at left back this season in fine form. Jack Grealish has only started 3 league games, but dare I say it has looked like he might be really growing into his time in a Manchester City shirt as well. Down the left side in particular, they really are deadly.
They are, and I thought Cancelo was brilliant at the weekend against Southampton. I mean, one of the best games he's had for City, just involved in everything, really good goal. I think involved in 2 other goals, maybe 1 assist and 1 pass in the build-up. I think they are good down that side. I know there's a lot of focus on Alexander-Arnold, but I don't think Gomez is a great defender, I must say. I think he's really struggled over the last couple of years, probably going back to the start of that, that really difficult season for Liverpool 2 years ago when they lost, was it the 7-2 against Villa, where he was quite ropey? I don't think he has that many more natural defensive qualities than Alexander-Arnold, to be honest, aside from being stronger physically and taller. I think positionally he's quite poor. So maybe Mark's right. Maybe having an extra centre-back will help in some ways, but I certainly don't think it solves the problem down that side.
And can you explain Pep Guardiola's relationship with his centre-backs? Something that I've never quite grasped. It seems to me like those in favour and those starting games seem to change a lot more under Pep Guardiola than other managers. You know, this season we're talking Diaz has had the most minutes, Stones, Ake, second and third, then Akanji, and Laporte barely involved at all. Talk me through that.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm always a little bit surprised about that myself. I mean, clearly Akanji's come in and made a good impact. And as I said earlier, against Manchester United, I thought he played two players who were probably the two most comfortable carrying the ball. I suppose maybe you could say Stones is as well. But it's almost like at times he picks more tactically in that position than other managers would, whereas other managers like to keep consistency. But yeah, I can't really explain how players kind of seem to drop completely out of favour, but he's got five good options there. And that's very rare for Guardiola throughout his career. I mean, often he's only had kind of a first choice two and a third, and then his next choice will be playing a midfielder in defence. At Barcelona, at Bayern and at City. Whereas, yeah, that's probably not going to happen this time. You can't see Rodri getting many minutes at centre-back because there's so many other options.
They're in good shape individually. They're in good shape collectively. But Mark, let's try and predict a way that Liverpool could hurt them. What's the most realistic way that Liverpool have joy against Manchester City on Sunday?
It's a very tough question to answer. The thing that it's more of me asking another question rather than posing an answer. But I think this season, has anyone really press them high and effectively? You know, Michael spoke about the centre-backs and did a great piece on how, yeah, Manchester United allowed the centre-backs to progress forward, and then that allowed further build-up, you know, in midfield and obviously in attack. And Liverpool did it so well against Manchester City in the FA Cup of just really getting them in a bit of a chokehold, pressing them really high, which we know that the best version of Liverpool like to do. Maybe if they do play something of a front four, they can try and really go for the throat there as well. The idea being, if Manchester City's build-up is disrupted right from the back, right from Edison, who famously, it was Zach Steffen who made the mistake for the FA Cup game, but Edison had something similar where, yeah, if Liverpool really do press really relentlessly, really high, would Manchester City's weakness be in build-up? If you really don't allow the midfielders to get on the ball to do their thing, obviously stop the delivery into Haaland and Phil Foden, etc., could that be maybe a way to stop them? But then you've got to really commit and keep that high line and then the space that could be, you know, in behind. So it's very risky, but my question is, could they be pressed?
I'll be watching through my fingers if Liverpool go with a proper high press from the start. It could be amazing. It could be disastrous. It should, Michael, be pretty entertaining. My last question to you is, could we feasibly see another, you know, kind of ridiculous scoreline? By which I mean, the big games in the Premier League over the last year or two seem to be completely different to 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I used to always think that a big Super Sunday game in the Premier League between two top four teams would always be quite fraught, quite cagey, and almost always end 1-1. I know that's obviously not true, but that's how it felt. Now, I've got the results from last season in front of me. Every single team practically had bonkers scorelines against the other big six. You know, United lost 5-0 and 4-0 to Liverpool. They beat Spurs and Arsenal 3-2. Man City beat Arsenal 5-0. They beat Manchester United 4-1. They lost 3-2 to Spurs. They drew 2-2 with Liverpool. We saw a 6-3 between City and United the other day. It's like 1930s scorelines now in these big games.
Yeah, it is a little bit. There's been a lot of goals. I think just a lot of goals in the league so far this year. I mean, we've had a 9-0 involving Liverpool. Even Manchester City have conceded 9 goals in their 9 games, which is not as good a defensive record as you would expect. So, yeah, possibly. I must say, I would fear for Liverpool if they concede an early goal. I think City is so rampant this year, and extra day rest in the week. Obviously, Haaland was rested as well. They are scoring a lot of goals, 33 from 9 games so far. So, yeah, if there are a lot of goals in this game, I don't think it's good for Liverpool.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, to finish off, just a quick conversation about the state of play when it comes to strikers at the Big Six Premier League clubs. It's an interesting discussion. Even over the summer, we were wondering what things would look like with Haaland, pretty good, as it turns out, with Nunez. Certainly plenty to discuss when it comes to him. Michael, among the Big Six, is it only Spurs that look the same up top as they did 12 months ago? Harry Kane at Spurs, with the other five, either very different or kind of still a bit uncertain.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair for different reasons, involving new signings, change of manager at Manchester United, and obviously a change of number nine. Yeah, there has been quite a lot of fluidity and a lot of change. And I think broadly most teams look better. I mean, City obviously look better up front. Arsenal, Jesus has had an incredible impact. Chelsea is the one I'm still not quite sure about, although Aubameyang is in good form and scoring goals. And Manchester United, you know, obviously without Ronaldo, you have less of a guaranteed source of goals. But I think most people would argue that overall they look a little bit more cohesive. So yeah, there's been a lot of change.
With Nunez, what have you made of his start? Did Liverpool need to sign someone more nailed on or ready to hit the ground running? Or is that simply unrealistic outside of Haaland and in the manner that they tend to recruit?
I think it's very difficult. I think they have the right approach in buying a player of his age and hoping that he will do it for 5 or 6 years. But I do think, yeah, you have to accept that you might have to take a bit of a hit as a player gets used to the league. I mean, Mane was just so consistent over such a number of years. But I think he's looked good. I mean, obviously he let himself down against Crystal Palace with that red card. But I thought on his first game against Fulham, the impact he made when he came on was really good. I really like his runs. I think he was excellent against Arsenal. You know, we really do demand that players adjust immediately these days, which I think is very unfair for a player who's not just adjusting to a different country, but really his first taste of a big league, with all due respect to Portuguese football. The majority of matches are not against good sides. So I've been quite impressed with him, really. I don't think he's going to be on Mane's level this season. But yeah, like I say, I think it's the right approach in the long term in the transfer market. And it's not just about him. They have other attackers there. They have Salah, they have Jota, they have Firmino, they have Diaz, who have all played at the right level for Liverpool. So I think the onus is often on those players, I think, to really step out when someone leaves, rather than the guy who's coming in as a newcomer.
Well, Firmino is certainly stepping up at the moment. 6 goals and 3 assists in his last 5 Premier League games. 2 more goals in the Champions League on Wednesday as well. So thriving from the increased competition. And someone did put it to me, perhaps thriving from actually having played reduced minutes last season compared to some of the Liverpool players who had about as intense a schedule as you can possibly have, Salah in particular. As for Arsenal, Gabriel Jesus, Mark, seems to have just transformed or helped to transform Arsenal's attacking play. Clearly a whirlwind of skill and energy when you're watching him play in an Arsenal shirt. What are his numbers like this season? What do they suggest about the impact he's had?
Yeah, I mean, before I get to it, to his numbers, I just love the way that he uses his body just to stave off from, you know, defenders. You can bring it down really neatly, but he just gets himself between man and ball, and he's the sort of things that can't be quantified. I really like about Gabriel Jesus, basically. But what can be quantified, I can walk through. And his goals and his expected goals are, you know, interesting to look at. But this season, it's not necessarily the highest per 90 minutes of his career. And that makes sense, right? Because Manchester City create so many chances and he scores goals as a consequence in recent seasons because of the quality of those chances. Perhaps slightly inflated at times of his Manchester City career because he's maybe coming on as a substitute against tired legs and things like that. But so it's not necessary that his expected goals and his goals per 90 are higher at Arsenal this season. But I think what's interesting is the touches in the box are most noticeable. So since 2017-18 for Manchester City, he never averaged more than 10 touches in the box per 90 minutes. And this season, he's averaging 11.3 per 90. So he's getting more involved in those dangerous areas. Unsurprising, given we know that the role he's being asked to play for Arteta, and especially comparing with last season where he's playing far more of a wide role. But it's just, I guess, it's just showing just how when he's being utilised in more central areas with the ability to drift and rotate with Arsenal's forward line, that it's suiting him sort of really well. He's far more involved in the play and getting the ball in far more dangerous areas. So I think the touches in the box, I think, are most noticeable for me.
Hey, Michael, how about Harry Kane's numbers? 8 goals in his first 9 Premier League games. It's an abnormal, sensational start that feels kind of normalised and less than sensational because of Erling Haaland, but seemingly in great goal-scoring form heading into the World Cup, targeting another World Cup golden boot.
Yeah, he's doing well. They switched to 3-5-2 at the weekends against Brighton. I thought it looked really good, actually, with Son and Kane just playing close to each other and combining on a couple of occasions, including for the goal, which I thought was actually a really, really good header from Kane, because I'm fairly sure that was a shot from Son rather than a cross, but he diverted it into the net brilliantly. So yeah, he's looking good. I'm not sure whether they'll stay in that shape, but yeah, I wouldn't be switching it immediately, because they did look better. I think they got Everton this weekend, haven't they? So yeah, Kane looking very good.
And then lastly, Chelsea and Manchester United, where I don't feel as sure on what the situation is when it comes to the number 9. You know, both have options here. Let's start with Chelsea. On Saturday, Havertz started up front against Wolves. Aubameyang is in the building, getting up to speed and already finished off some nice chances. Raheem Sterling has played in, you know, through the middle-esque roles, although we know things are going to look fluid under Graham Potter. And even Armando Broja came off the bench and scored a lovely goal on Saturday. So, Michael, what do you perceive to be the sort of number 9 that Graham Potter will want to play in the majority of games, in the big games? Which one of those players do you expect to see starting, for example, Champions League knockout games?
I'm not sure he would have brought in Aubameyang if he was there for the end of the transfer window, I must say. I thought it was interesting the weekend they played Havertz up front, as you say. Not only did he score a header, you know, a kind of classic number 9 goal, but I thought that the three behind him played really well as well. I thought Mount was really involved. Gallagher looked lively as well. Pulisic got a goal. I don't know if those three are going to look as good if Aubameyang plays up front. I just don't think his link play is very good. I know it's not an original point, but every time I watch him, I'm just surprised how poor his passing is. Just like simple 10-yard passes back to goal. Yeah, I would have Havertz as my number 9 going forward. I know he's inconsistent. He's not going to score as many goals as Aubameyang, but I do think he's a really good player.
I know it's one of my favourite words to use in this podcast, but I think it's about the alchemy of the forward line, which I know I've used, but I do think that's true, where you think of Havertz, Sterling and Mount has almost made himself indispensable with everything that he does in picking up pockets of space, all the things we've spoken about before, that I think it's as much about what they do off the ball, really relentless in their positioning, but also their press of, yeah, Havertz, Sterling and Mount, that yes, you could bring Aubameyang in and he is far more of a clinical finisher, that's just true, but what do you then lose off the ball? And he developed a bit of a more, bit of a stronger press towards his sort of the latter stages of his time at Arsenal. But the combination of those three to be able to rotate as well as, you know, picking up central spaces and in more of the half spaces on and off the ball, I think is a real strength of Chelsea. So if Potter can really get that clicking, that would be really useful.
Potter just testing out some different potions at the moment, waiting for the most potent, for the right one. Of course, David Ornstein of The Athletic reporting that personal terms have been agreed for Christopher Nkunku as well to join the Blues this summer. Mark, where does Nkunku fit into this? Is he going to be an out-and-out 9? Is he going to be yet another player that might play in two little 10 spots behind there? What might that look like in your eyes?
Yeah, he's quite a versatile player. He doesn't, I wouldn't class him as an out-and-out number 9 off the shoulder. He's a very clinical finisher. Some of the finishes, if you watch them back, are brilliant. He doesn't snatch at the chances. He's really composed, really calm. So it can never be a bad thing to have him in the side. But again, you just think, Chelsea becoming a bit too top heavy. I think we had this same sort of question when Lukaku came in as well, of just how many forwards they have. And Nkunku being added, as I say, never a bad thing, but how would you fit them all in, keep those big names happy as well, never mind, like, you know, getting them on the pitch. So an interesting one, but there's no doubt that he's a good finisher, able to sometimes drift wide as well, pick up little pockets, but not necessarily a central number 9.
Lastly, Manchester United, Michael, I was wondering if you have any steer on how you think Ten Hag wants to approach things in terms of his number nine. Marcus Rashford has started the most Premier League games through the middle. Martial, of course, is there. Cristiano Ronaldo's played some minutes as well. Is Rashford the one for Ten Hag, the best fit for the way that he wants to play?
I'm not sure he's made up his mind. I mean, we know Ronaldo really isn't his idea of a centre forward. Rashford, I think, has been okay. I actually think stylistically of the three, Martial is the best. I think Martial is the best with his back to goal. I think he can come short and link play. He played a really good pass in behind for Antony at the weekend for the opening goal. The problem is injuries and inconsistency. But yeah, I think long term, if Ten Hag is there in 2 years' time from now, I think they've got another centre forward completely. I don't know who that might be, but I just think they might bring in someone else. But yeah, Rashford's been looking much livelier. A bit unfortunate not to get a goal at the weekend. I still am not completely sure he's better up front than wide, personally.
Kylian Mbappe might be available. Just getting a bit of topical chat into the pod to finish. Reportedly wants out of PSG. The sort of mid-October transfer rumour that I think we can all get behind. As we're on the subject, if Mbappe was to have his pick, hypothetically, of the big six to join, Michael, where would you like to see him? Where do you think he would fit in best based on the current tactical setups of the big six?
If it's just fit in best, maybe Arsenal. I think he could play the Gabriel Jesus role quite well.
Well, suggestions that he supposedly wants to play off a number nine. So maybe he could, unfortunately, yeah, take the spot of Gabriel Martinelli, which would feel harsh based on his form. But
yeah, actually, he could play that role very well. I think he could play for any of the any of the top six. And I think he can play pretty much equally well through the middle, on the left, on the right, regardless of what he thinks.
Conte can play a 3-5-2, can't he, Mark? Mbappe off Kane?
I mean, yeah, the way that they play, get him to stretch his legs and make the most of that space in behind. I was going to try and think of something rogue like Brighton or something, just to see whether I could be a bit contrary. But yeah, Tottenham could be a good one, actually, stylistically.
It's just a shame that Sean Dyche's Burnley are no longer in the Premier League. That could have been absolute perfection. Mbappe off Ashley Barnes. Theathletic.com/tactics. Guys, Michael, Mark, all of their colleagues working hard all day, every day to provide the best written football coverage out there. A lot of US sports being covered in depth as well. The NBA season starts soon, and as much off-season drama as ever, and plenty of intrigue ahead of the new season. That's possibly my second favourite part of the Athletic website after the football section. So there's a little recommendation for me. It's a good time to get into the NBA if you have the bandwidth for another sport, and a subscription to The Athletic is the best way of doing so. So theathletic.com/tactics to sign up today for your annual subscription with a discount as well on that link. Thank you so much to Mark and to Michael for helping me preview the big game in the Premier League this weekend. Possibly not the fixture of the last 4 years, but you never know. Liverpool 5, Manchester City 5. Previewed on the Football Tactics Pod. We'll talk again next week. Hope you've enjoyed this and enjoy your weekend.
The Athletic.